Welcome to SciShow Tangents, as the lightly competitive science knowledge showcase. I'm your host, Hank Green, and joining me this week, as always, is science expert Sari Riley.
Hello.
And our resident everyman, Sam Schultz.
Hello.
If there could be an animal that doesn't exist that you wish it could exist, what would it be? I will answer first.
Okay.
Okay.
I thought it would be a pelican, which is a pelican that's a unicorn.
That sounds scary.
Yeah.
Sounds
but I
not very I, useful.
Well, yeah. It turns out what happened was I don't know if this is going to be out yet when this podcast comes out, but I keep a lookout for it. I was just on Drawfee this morning. Like, we recorded an episode. Drawfee is a show where you weird prompts and then they draw the prompts, and I gave them animals I wished existed. And the first one was not the pelican, but the second one was a pelican, and it turned out not as glorious and magical and mystical as I would have liked. It was terrifying, and I don't want it to exist. So pelican is right out. But the thing that turned out really great was the Tyrannosaurus rex, which is a giant otter that is also a reptile, and it really loves coffee, and it goes hard. It could totally tear you apart and kill you, but it wouldn't, because it's adorable and lovely and happy. That's what I want to exist. A happy, kind, thoughtful, giant otter dinosaur.
Good.
More happy and thoughtful animals would be nice. That couldn't hurt, could it?
No.
Yeah. Totally. That's the vein I was thinking, too, before even learning about the how do you say it? Tyrannosaurus rex. I was thinking, so a glass frog, which are those tiny little guys that you can see through, see their little organs. They're sometimes greenish, sometimes clearish, but the size of a Volkswagen Beetle. And they're very friendly. Very friendly. That's part of the description. And I don't know, you could ride on their backs sometimes. They'd carry you across the water. They'd be a little slimy, but very lovable. And I don't know.
That's just Yoshi.
Yeah, you can just hang out. I want Yoshi.
Yeah, maybe what we want is Yoshi. Yeah. And now that you've said it, I would like Yoshi to exist.
Yoshi would be fun.
It'd be weird to go on Drawfee and be like, can you draw Yoshi for me?
I'm thinking but of a dinosaur. Yeah.
Yoshi, but I want to see his heart.
Yes, that's what I want then. Yoshi, but transparent, so I can learn a
thing.
You can
see his great big heart.
Yeah, see his great big heart, see his little guts.
The biggest part. And when he eats you, you can see yourself inside.
Yeah, you can see the apple-shaped blob go in and then squish into poop.
You gotta be able to see the poop. It's important. It's vital. How else will you know he needs to poop? An animal that I wish existed was a talking bird. How about that?
Those exist.
Those exist, Sam.
Shoot.
Okay. Okay. Dream a little bigger.
Okay. A little bigger.
Imagine.
Animal that I wish existed was one of them, in the Flintstones, where they have the vacuum that's an elephant, and he would vacuum your floor for you, but be your pet.
Yeah, that's great.
All of those animals would be great, actually. If we
the ones that just for some reason, instead of having scissors, they had a pterodactyl. somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah. You want that elephant that likes every kind of fuzz up its nose.
Yeah, it's their favorite thing to do is just go around and suck it up and say it's a living. And I'd say you're right. And I'd have to pay him every week, I guess, too.
Everybody, we're at SciShow Tangents on Twitter. Tell us which animal you wish existed. And then we'll all like each other and have a good time.
That sounds like a great conversation for Twitter. I need more good. I would love to do fake animals. Just hide from the other stuff.
Yeah, please don't show me anything that doesn't make me happy at this point. I'm tired. Every week here on Tangents, we get together, try to one-up, amaze, and delight each other with science facts, while also trying to stay on topic and failing. Our panelists are playing for glory, but they're also playing for Hank Bucks, which I'll be awarding as we play. And at the end of the episode, one of them's going to win. They're going to win the episode, and they're going to go home feeling that particular rare joy. Now, as always, we introduce this week's topic with the traditional science poem. This week is going to be from me. A collection of people, just a few, is definitely not anything new. And a few more than that, and then, again, that's a very old trend. Multiply that by a dozen and see it's starting to look a bit weird to me, and multiply that again by 10,002. That's something that's entirely new. It can be pretty or gritty, but not itty-bitty. You can pack us together, and you get a city. A city that clings to the side of a hill. A city that's home to a lumber mill. A city that needs a giant landfill. A city that's just Jacksonville. A city that millions of people... a city that's millions of people... reaching for something they can't describe. For thousands of years we've done this, but still we do not know why. That's my city poem.
It was a beautiful city poem.
The city is probably not a thing that's particularly easy to define, except that it is definitely a large gathering of people who all live in one place.
Yep.
But the lines between it, I often am not sure whether I live in a city, for example.
They're very blurry. Everyone, it seems, takes the I'll know it when I see it definition approach, which, you know, we've done for plenty of episodes here because it's easy. Yeah. You can say, here's the line.
Well, it's almost not hard because everybody agrees that nobody knows what a city is. Because it's not like one more person moved to town. We officially are a city. Though I think in some places it is legally designated. Right. But that's just the law.
That's which is where also, it gets complicated, where people have to define a city for quantitative studies because us scientists, we've got to be like, we've got to set a threshold, even if it's arbitrary. And then a bunch of people set different thresholds for laws and for studies and for, I don't know, mostly laws. And then things get complicated. So, for example, using different countries, everyone has a different minimum population size to define an urban area or a city. So, can be like 200 in Denmark, 2,000 in Argentina, 5,000 in India, 50,000 in Japan, even 100,000 in China, which are still like relatively small.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Missoula is 70,000 and sometimes I straight call it a town.
Yeah.
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 Usually it seems like from what I found across the internet, and by that I mean a couple papers that I had time to look at, is that statisticians generally have settled around at least 50,000 inhabitants, but then also a certain density of that.
Yeah, you can draw a line that it has 50,000 people in it.
Mm-hmm.
In but any place not... with 50,000 people.
But it has to be around 1,500 inhabitants per square kilometer. Just not too densely packed. I don't have a...
Sure.
Comparison for that. Mm-hmm. But it seems like the definition of city versus town versus village or whatever is people, the density of the people. And then you can start layering on other sociological and other concepts like building structure, cultural, behavioral approach, like the diversity in languages that you find in an area. Mm-hmm. Are you going to classify it as a city? But numbers are the easiest one to draw.
But then there's also like the reality that a lot of cities used to be like a bunch of smaller towns and they just got sort of like smooshed into one. Yeah. And you know, LA is this way where it's Los Angeles, but then it's like they used to be lots of different pockets that just all got connected together. And now at what point is it not Los Angeles anymore? Like, And there are even places like there's inholdings in LA. Like I think I don't know which one it is, but there are little places that are like, nope, we're not LA. We're entirely surrounded by LA, but we're not LA.
The Vatican situation.
Yeah, it's a Vatican situation, but it's Burbank.
Yeah.
Instead of the Pope, it's Rhett and Link. The leaders of Burbank, everyone knows.
Yeah, so I don't know when that comes. So a lot of languages only have a couple words for cities, too. It's like, you got the big one and you got the small one. And English has three, like city, town, village.
I would have guessed we had more.
We have more, I guess, Hamlet. If you start subdividing Hamlet.
Yeah,
Hamlet. Okay, borough.
Uh-huh. Sari, do you know anything about etymology of these words?
You know, the etymology of city is just as complicated as... our definition of city, in that we just used a lot of words to describe places that people lived. So city comes from Latin civitas or civitem, which is more applied to like citizenship or a member of a community. So it's like, and came from the word civis, which means like a townsperson. And then there was a companion word that meant city in Latin, which was urbs, which is a great word. I don't know why we don't have words like herbs anymore. and then it seems like historically, as Rome fell and lost its prestige, then herbs was out and civitas was in. And then we were like, we're not calling them herbs anymore. We're calling them cities.
But they can still be urban.
But they can still be urban, yes. But the idea of urbanness carried on throughout history. But we just don't call them urbans. We call them urban centers, I guess, because city now.
Yeah. And we can sometimes the suburbs are the burbs, which is very close to herbs, but not quite there. The herbs and the burbs is the name of every Hallmark Christmas special. I guess it's rural usually. So the rurbs and the herbs and the burbs.
The herbs and the burbs coming together for love on Christmas Day.
Always. That Christmas tree farm isn't going to do its own books.
It's going to do its own social media postings. A hot shot from the herbs to come here.
To the herbs. All right. Before we get too deep, it's time for us to move on to the quiz portion of our show. Are you ready to be quizzed?
Yes.
It's going to be a city's truth or fail. Life can be tough in the big city, and it can require lots of changes and adaptations for humans, but also for animals. So scientists have been studying city animals, leading to some very educated hypotheses and conclusions about how our habits and buildings have changed our animal neighbors. The following are three possible tales of city-based animal evolution, but only one of them is rooted in actual scientific fact. You're going to have to tell me which one. Story number one. Summers can make city streets unbearably hot, of course. But alas, animals still find themselves needing to hit that pavement. So in San Juan, the Puerto Rican crested anole, or anole, has been adapting its lizard body to deal with that heat by growing an additional layer of skin on its feet that shields it from all that heat on the pavement.
Hot foot.
But that might not be the true fact. It might be story number two. One of the first things about going to a new city is that you got to find some new places to eat. But all that food can be overwhelming to both our choices and our bellies. To make good use of discarded takeout food throughout New York City, white-footed mice have upgraded their metabolism with genetic changes that make them better able to digest fatty foods. But that also might be a lie, and it might be this one. Story number three. In a city full of crowds and noise, it can be hard to stand out. But everybody's still looking for love, which means that everybody's also looking for clever strategies to get a date, even if they are birds. In the city of Leiden, great tits make their songs stick out to potential mates by developing new melodies that are actually copied from popular hits that can be heard on radios throughout the city. So, is it story number one, lizards developing pavement protective paws? Story number two, pizza mice? Or story number three, great tits cover human songs to stand out in the crowd?
For the first one, lizards developing little hot feet.
Hot feet.
That makes sense, I think.
It does make sense.
Yeah, it does get hot.
You get, you can't have shoes. They can't buy lizard shoes in this economy. No way.
No.
But you can walk around and just get thicker skin.
I can't think of any compelling reason that wouldn't be it.
Well, there are two other options it could be.
Oh, okay.
So that's the main one.
What about pizza mice, Sam? I feel like
Their genome is changed to allow them to better digest fatty foods. So like mice might traditionally eat grain, but now they eat a lot of cheese and et cetera. Just like fettuccine Alfredo, bacon.
A little prosciutto.
All those big city foods.
They're hanging out at the Olive Garden.
My first thought was that white-footed mice aren't real. Is that, are they?
No, they're real.
Oh, okay. Well, that blows that out of the water.
Great tits are also real.
Yes.
I know that one.
And anole lizards are also real. Anole lizards? Mm-hmm. I don't know how to say it.
I like anole better, so I'd like to motion it be anole.
Oh, Jay says anole.
Anole. Oh. That sounds like a pasta, though. Pizza mice are eating the anole.
The anole Alfredo.
Yeah.
That was my Italian accent.
Yeah, I think shockingly mine was a little better than yours.
It was way better. Holy Alfredo.
Okay, well, then the third one, the tits singing the pop songs. I would say, I don't think they're known to be one of the birds that talk of Sam's mythical dreams. I don't know if they have enough mimicry, and I guess with enough urban exposure.
The question is, do y'all know enough about great tits to know whether they're good at mimicry?
I don't even know what they look like, and I'm too afraid to Google it.
No, they're just like a little normal little bird. They look kind of like...
Yeah, they look like normal little birds.
Like if you pictured a quintessential bird in a picture book, they look like that, I think.
Yeah, they look a little like that.
That's a great tit.
Yeah, no, and I Googled great tit just now, and it is all birds.
Those little guys ain't mimicking anything. They're just going, do-do-do, do-do-do. Their heads are too small to keep all that stuff in their brain to mimic it.
I'm going to go with pizza mice because I think I like the little ratatouille. It's ratatouille in real life. He eats a pizza. Yes.
While you were talking, I came around on the pizza mouse thing. I think that is the one it is. Because you said the thing about they were eating grain, now they're eating cheese. I feel like that makes sense to me. And they probably can, like, change really quickly their genomes, right? Isn't that something mice can do?
I mean, it's something that happens to, it's evolution, natural selection, and it is a thing that happens to all species.
Like that. They're like, I need to eat this cheese right away.
There does seem to be some indication that certain animals can evolve faster than others, which is very interesting and something that maybe should also go on my SciShow list.
If cheese is on the line, you're evolving to eat it.
Well, also just fast generations. They make a lot of babies really fast.
Yeah,
that's natural selection.
So I will second.
But lizards also make a lot of babies.
It's true.
And
nobody's buying your lizard story, Hank. Come on, we're going with Pizza Rat.
Well, researchers have found that the Puerto Rican crested anole has been adapting its feet to city life by making them better able to climb buildings.
So not...
You're right! It's the Pizza Rat! It turns out that like buildings are smoother than the stuff that those anoles would or anoles would normally climb in nature. And so they have adapted their feet to be better able at climbing smooth buildings. But Pizza Rat or Pizza Mouse is true. A paper published in 2017 compared white-footed mice living in parks inside New York City to white-footed mice living in parks outside the city, and the research sequenced their genetic material. And they found that in general, the city mice had changes in genes that helped digest and metabolize lipids and carbohydrates. The interesting thing here is that scientists working on this paper disagree about what could be driving the changes, at least as of 2017 when the paper was published. One of them thought the changes might be due to the types of plants and insects available in the city versus not city parks, whereas the other went with the cheeseburger hypothesis, where the idea is that the mice are adapting to fatty foods that are in the trash, which honestly, that makes a lot more
that
sense
adds
to me.
Up, yeah.
But figuring out the actual reason is going to require a little more study.
You got a bug in front of you and a chicken strip or whatever.
I mean, God, there's so much food inside of a quarter of a hamburger.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But the great tits, this is actually really interesting, too. They were not mimicking songs, but they did adjust their songs in different parts of the city based on the way that noise travels. So there's places where there are a lot of ambient noise, which is lower frequency. And in those places, the tits sang higher frequency songs to be heard over that noise than in places where there wasn't as much of that rumbly, bumbly noise.
They were doing some sound engineering, just like our friend Tuna.
Make my frequencies pop, Tuna.
Yeah, you great tit.
Oh, boy. All right, so that means that Sam and Sari both get the point. We're going to take a short break now, and then it'll be time for the Fact Off. All right, everybody, get ready for the Fact Off. Our panelists have brought in science facts to present to me in an attempt to blow my mind. And after they've presented their facts, I will judge them and award Hank Bucks any way I see fit with an emphasis on which one of these is going to make the best TikTok. There's a trivia question, though, to decide who goes first. In the 18th century, the city of Paris had a problem. They had too many dead bodies lying around in mass graves in their cemeteries, creating unsanitary conditions for the city's residents. That's It's a problem for the city of Paris. It's not a problem for the dead people anymore. They're fine. So they decided to handle this problem by throwing those corpses into pits that the Romans had dug up long before to mine limestone. The final result is known as the Paris Catacombs, a network of tunnels under the city that are filled with the skeletal remains that have been deposited there. Approximately how many bodies were moved from those cemeteries to the Paris Catacombs?
Oh. Did you say what year it was?
I said that it was the 18th century.
Okay. That's a long time, I feel like, for France to have been there. But I don't know when that started.
You're a Halloween expert, Sam. I feel like you're going to be good at this question.
Ooh. Yeah. What's the spookiest number?
Yeah. How many bodies is too many? How many bodies is like, it goes from being cool to, and then you start shoving them somewhere else.
Skeletons are different. Bodies is one. Skeletons.
Very true.
Is 700,000 skeletons.
Okay. Oh.
If it's 700,001 skeletons, you got to get me out of there.
Okay.
Okay. I'm going to say 400,000.
6 million.
Oh, God. I knew it was going to be way more than that.
I have no sense of scale of big numbers.
How long would that take?
Well, I think it happened over a fairly long period of time. And initially, the catacombs, which are around 20 meters under the ground, so pretty far down there, it was just like sort of the bones just were kind of piled and dumped inside. And then later, this guy, Henri Carr de Thury, that's my French accent for you. I don't know if he decided or if he was sort of hired for this. I assume that somebody was paying him. He started to arrange the bones into something more artful. And now you can go and see these very kind of intense human remains structures that are built down in the catacombs.
I hope somebody asked him to do that.
Yeah. It's not just like I don't know. I didn't really know what else to do with my time. There are about 300 kilometers worth of tunnels down there. Only 1.5 kilometers are open to the public. So 300 kilometers of tunnels.
Will
fit 6 million skeletons.
Jesus. I had no idea. I thought that was like a religious thing. But no, the catacombs. No.
Well, it was consecrated. They did say, this is a religious place
now.
This is
fine. What we're doing is fine. Yeah.
Put the bones there. We promise it's great.
God said it was cool if we did this.
All right, Sam, that means that you get to decide who goes first.
I think I'll go first. I like to go first now. I'm being brave. Like I said before, I'm brave. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You're a monster.
A monster?
Yeah. Professional. You're going after it.
Cool.
You're a champion.
I like that. These are nice things. Nobody ever says anything nice about me. A lot of birds are not great at regulating heat. They can't sweat, so they pant to cool down. But panting requires a lot of muscle movement, which also generates heat. So it's not the most efficient cool down method. And birds' insulating feathers can also work against them by trapping lots of heat close to their bodies. So it just kind of sounds like it sucks to be a hot bird. And baby birds are babies, and much like babies are worse at everything than adults are, baby birds are worse at heat regulation than adult birds. They mostly just have to depend on their parent sitting on them to keep them in okay temperature, which also doesn't sound like the best way to do it, but
yeah.
Well, they've been around for a while, so what do we know? And these bird temperature issues are exacerbated by global climate change. So I found several reports from organizations about baby birds dying in their nests or dying from trying to leave their nests too early to like find somewhere cooler to go, which is just grim and horrible. Mm-hmm. And you would think that since cities are heat sinks, meaning that due to what they're made out of, cities tend to be hotter than like the area around them. Baby birds that live in cities would be doing way worse than baby birds that live in, like, the woods. However, a recently published study looked at 760 broods of great tits. I was scared to say it, but you said it for me. From 2013 to 2018, half of which lived in cities and half of which were in forests, and found that as the number of hot days in a given year increased, the mortality rate of city-based chicks did not increase and, in fact, seemed to decrease, I think is what the paper was saying, as opposed to forest-dwelling chicks who died more often as the amount of hot days increased, even though cities were indeed hotter than the woods that these other great tits were living in.
They find the air conditioning. They go and they go to Barnes & Noble like the rest of us.
Yeah. They go into Starbucks and they get a cup of water. They just stand there for a while. A few other things that they noticed. Urban great tits usually laid fewer eggs, and their chicks had less feathers and were smaller. Mm. And these adaptations most likely come from their city slicking lifestyle. So since cities were already warmer, these birds were possibly laying less eggs because less babies equals less body heat. And their chicks maybe got a leg up by growing less feathers to keep cool. And city birds were generally smaller, which could be attributed to less food availability in cities. But the researchers also cited previous studies of city-dwelling animals like birds and insects that found that it's common for city animals to be smaller than rural. It's common for city animals to be smaller than rural ones.
The Rurbans.
Urban birds. And also common for smaller animals to be more resistant to extreme temperatures. Meanwhile, rural birds didn't have to adapt to such an extreme change, and they haven't caught up adaptation-wise as the world heats up. So in conclusion, sorry, birds, for global warming. That's our bad. Mm-hmm. But also, they should be thanking us for building the harsh, unnaturally warm asphalt hellscapes that have prepared some of them to live in the global hellscape to come.
Rural birds are in trouble. Yeah. But those urban birds,
moved to the city
the
birds.
Urban burbs, are going to do great. That's weird. I want to see little pictures of these tiny little hairless baby birds.
Oh,
these tiny hairless
birds.
Baby tits.
And I'm scared to Google great tits, more scared to Google great tit chick. I can't look that up.
Just look
my
up
parental,
baby.
My parental alert will go off.
Yeah. Yeah. This is my work computer. So this seems to be another, could have been in the truth or fail, animals adjusting to cities.
Yeah.
Which, of course, they do. And in lots of ways. I always thought that squirrels should evolve a sort of brighter color scheme so that they're less likely to get hit by the cars.
They're exactly road colored.
I know.
That's not right.
Don't do that. Yeah. Be like bright pink. All right. Sari, what do you got?
So much infrastructural engineering goes into cities, like getting electricity to people safely and efficiently. An important piece of that puzzle is substations, where there are incoming power lines, outgoing lines, and a bunch of machinery in the middle that helps process the electricity in some way. For example,
that's great. Yeah.
I'll list some examples in case you want some electricity words. For example, some can change the voltage of electricity to make it easier
Very
to go
important.
Long distance or
mm-hmm.
safe for consumers to use, so raising it or lowering it. Switch from AC to DC current, or lots of other important transition-y things from big system to personal use. And in many areas, these substations look very industrial, with steel structures supporting on the metal machinery, surrounded by a chain-link fence and big warning signs. But that's not the case in some parts of Toronto, Canada. So the city of Toronto started to have electric power around the 1880s, supplied by private companies. But in 1911, the municipal electricity company Toronto Hydro was established, helping funnel electricity from generators at Niagara Falls, among other places, to residents. And as part of this, they needed to build more substations in neighborhoods, especially as the urban area grew post-World War II. But instead of sticking with the classic industrial structure with keep-out signs, Toronto Hydro hired a bunch of architects to disguise neighborhood substations in whatever building style the neighborhood called for. So basically, during the 1950s and 1960s, Toronto Hydro built a bunch of fake film set houses and office building-shaped boxes with circuit breakers and voltage dials and heavy equipment inside them instead of, you know, living spaces for humans. These houses still had decorative windows, landscaping, and working doors for engineers to go inside. And if you look at pictures, they look pretty darn normal, besides the occasional chain across a driveway or a warning high voltage sign plastered on a door. I really looked for this, but there aren't a wealth of city planning texts online. But a 2016 conference proceeding from an architectural historian named Amy Clark describes how this sort of architectural camouflage was a big trend throughout the 20th century, not just with electrical transformers, but with public transit ventilation or other city utilities that needed to be sprinkled amongst homes. And while these buildings maybe didn't reflect an industrial strength or what was going on inside, she writes that they, quote, contributed to an experience of suburban life that matched the aesthetic expectations of the communities, end quote, which basically means people don't like ugly things and want to pretend that they're in a little quiet little community humdrumming along. So hide all the big machines. I don't want to think about power plants.
Yeah, this is also done with pump stations, which like sewage pump stations, where you're like, most sewage just sort of travels downhill, but eventually there's no more downhill to travel, so you have to pump it back up. And there's a bunch of pump stations that just look like houses.
Yeah.
But if you look, the windows aren't like that. You can't see through them. They're just glass in front of wood.
Dark.
Or like painted wood.
Mm-hmm. But apparently the modern electrical grid doesn't require Toronto to build these kinds of small neighborhood substations anymore. So they're gradually going out of commission. I don't know about other public utilities, how they're going. But mostly this was weird because I didn't know that these existed. And all this makes me wonder what the next movement will be in urban planning and infrastructure. Will we still want to hide our public works, or do we want to draw more attention to them so that people can know how much work and cool things like cool science is going on in our neighborhoods? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
I wish people looked at the substation and were like, wow, look at what we do together. Mm-hmm. But the Missoula, we've got a substation downtown that is right now being redone, and they're putting like a big art wall around it so you can't see it, and it's going to be murals and stuff, which is also cool.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also like, you know, there's a lot of, like, it's pretty amazing. That we
gotta go start standing down there, giving people some talks.
So I can go with Sam with the city-dwelling baby birds that might have a leg up in coping with global warming, or Sari's old Toronto electric substations designed as houses. And you're tied, so I really have to pick which one of these is good and better. They're both good. I'm gonna go with the baby birds because I was aware of the substations before. It's not a new fact to me, but it'd be a good TikTok, though. But I'm gonna go with the baby birds.
Now you can never do a TikTok about the other one, though. Legally.
It's a little. It's kind of a little bit of good news, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit good news because it's like, look, animals can handle things if we give them the time to handle the things.
Yeah, all the animals just have to move to the city. And yeah,
everybody,
be fine.
Don't worry, they'll figure it out. That's the good news. We're good on global warming. The tits have figured it out. Now it's time to ask the science couch, where we've got a listener question for our couch of finely honed scientific minds.
At CrystalR99 and at Ryan Laser ask, does living in a city change your physiology? How about your immunity?
Ooh.
Changes those birds' physiology.
It sure
and
does.
Lizards and mice.
You know, all I can say about this before Sari goes is I feel like somebody's done some research and it's found something interesting, but I have no idea what it is. Am I right?
Yeah, you're right. So one of the most cited studies that tackles this topic was published in 2010 in the journal Evolution, and specifically studied genetics from ancient humans or older populations of humans compared to modern. And it's like a very difficult thing to study human evolution over time for a lot of reasons, but they specifically looked at 17 different human populations living across Europe, Asia, and Africa, and analyzed DNA samples and found that populations that lived in more urban settlements had higher frequencies of a gene allele that was resistant to tuberculosis and leprosy. So big diseases that spread through urban areas. And so that in itself, a lot of the clickbait articles about it, I'll be nicer to the journalists. A lot of the popular science articles about this equate that to, well, cities mean that you build up your genetic resistance to diseases.
No, that's but, not individuals.
Yeah.
Not individuals, populations.
It's populations. And so you have to think of the number of people that died of those diseases. And then the survivors are the ones that pass down the genetic resistance throughout generations. And so really what the study concluded was generally that infectious disease loads are higher in urban environments and like seriously affect human populations to the point where genetic markers can be passed down through generations. Like it affects human evolution to that level. But there is evidence that like increased pollution and toxins obviously in soil, water, air, can lead to health impacts, whether it's increased rates of asthma or cognitive disparities or all other kinds of physical illnesses, cancers, whatnot. So then there's like that portion of it, which is the different places in society for a variety of reasons affect your health in different ways. And then there's the whole idea of like, should I raise my kids in a city or in the country? Because I don't want them to be allergic to things. And right. that revolves around the idea of like the hygiene hypothesis, which is the idea that in overly sanitized spaces, people worry that children are not being exposed to enough microbes or like different allergens. And so then they build up these intense mm-hmm. immune responses to things that would otherwise be normal.
There does seem to be some people who just get sick a lot less than me, particularly. and immune systems are definitely different, and some appear to be better than others.
Yeah.
Mine sucks.
Mine's pretty good. I think I lucked out in whatever genetic lottery. Yeah. I can't really smell, but everything else, I'm pretty fine.
That's not ideal, but also that there's some perks there. If you want to ask the Science Couch your question, you can follow us on Twitter at @SciShowTangents, where we'll tweet out topics for upcoming episodes every week. Or you can join our Patreon and get access to our Discord and ask us there. Thank you to @CowboyCrab on Discord, @CammyJBoy, and everybody else who asked us your questions for this episode. If you like the show and you want to help us out, super easy to do that. First, you can go to patreon.com/scishowtangents. You can become a patron and get access to things like our newsletter and our bonus episodes and even our Cars 2 commentary. Second, you can leave us a review wherever you listen. That helps us know what you like about the show and helps other people know how great we are. And finally, if you want to show your love for SciShow Tangents, just
tell people about us.
Thank you for joining us. I've been Hank Green.
I've been Sari Riley.
And I've been Sam Schultz.
SciShow Tangents is created by all of us and produced by Sam Schultz. Our editor is Seth Glicksman. Our story editor is Alex Billow. Our social media organizer is Julia Buzz Bezio. Our editorial assistant is Deboki Chakravarti. Our sound design is by Joseph Tuna Medish. Our executive producers are Kaylin Hoffmeister and me, Hank Green. And we couldn't make any of this without our patrons on Patreon. Thank you. And remember, the mind is not a vessel to be filled, but a fire to be lighted.
But one more thing. City sewer systems are engineering marvels, and we have a variety of ways to unclog pipes that have too much poop and other junk inside, including spraying high-pressure water or scraping out buckets of waste. In addition to those modern methods, though, the city of Paris uses an innovation that was first showcased at the Paris World's Fair in 1878. Giant balls! These iron or wooden balls are custom fit to the diameter of various sewer pipes, the biggest of them being around 8 feet in diameter. And they work exactly like how you'd think they would work. The balls get shoved through the pipes and scrape away all the poop on the side, and they push the sludge out the other side. They're doing some weird stuff underground in Paris, is what we're learning today.